I knew that these large families were culturally relevant to the French Caribbean and really throughout the Caribbean, and certainly in New Orleans. I knew that this was really a common way for people to organize their families. It's a long-standing adaptation to slavery, to live in large families and to be able to share resources and child care and to survive the insults and indignities of slavery and the legacies of slavery. We set about looking for a large family and ultimately found one in Dallas. Of this large family that I later mapped all the kinship networks and found that there were more than 300 people who all lived in a very close proximity of about 15 minutes from each other. 155 of those family members evacuated together to Dallas ahead of the storm, ahead of Katrina, to a relative's home where she had beckoned them to come, knowing that she would be able to provide some sort of help. I don't think she ever imagined that so many would come, but they did, so it was there that the whole story began.
What happened to them in the aftermath of Katrina? Did they stay in Dallas? Are they still there?
We should say that they didn't relocate. What happened is they evacuated, as they are practiced in doing, for each hurricane that threatens to come ashore. So they had evacuated ahead of the storm. And when they learned that, in fact, the area where their communities were situated and have always been situated for as far back as anyone knows, back into slave days, when they learned that their homes were all destroyed, all the contents of all of their homes and many of the homes themselves had to be hauled away, that meant that these 155 people actually did have to stay put in Dallas. I will tell you that they were very concerned to get back just as fast as they could. So one of the things that happened in Dallas was they gathered regularly, which was part of their ritual everyday practice from home, and they would replicate those kinds of practices in Dallas and gather to share home-cooked food, and they would talk to each other about each other's stories, because men would go back and locate provisions in the area of food like shrimp and crab that they recognized and and made it possible for people to cook the way they were used to cooking with the ingredients they were used to cooking with. And so that kind of thing happened for 4 to 5 months, and then everyone was poised to get back just as fast as possible. But the delay was really a product of not having anywhere to live, that, you know, just needing basic shelter.
The title of the book is Standing in the Need: Culture, Comfort, and Coming Home After Katrina. And you talk about culture in various different contexts. You spoke about the ritual around family sharing food and the type of foods and how that was so important. But you use some terms that hopefully you can explain to our listeners: wounded culture and recovery culture.
What I'm basically trying to do is point out that in any disaster situation, you have people who are hurt. And those people, unlike many people who assume that disaster basically strips us to the barest bone of humanity, because we are all facing such really fundamental, elementary needs of food and shelter and clothing and so forth. The truth is, that's just not the case. People who experience disaster cling to their cultural values more than ever. They become prominent and important almost as a survival default to what is familiar, what is a source of comfort. And so when I talk about wounded culture, I'm talking about the people in any given situation who are hurt have some kind of culture. It will, of course, vary. And there are many cultural groups with distinctive values and distinctive shared kinds of everyday practices in the New Orleans area, in Mississippi, in the bayou areas. They are different than the city areas. So it's not one thing. It's many things. But the point is to recognize there is some kind of cultural vitality that has helped people cohere as a group of people and create meaningful lives as a group of people. and that that needs to be recognized. And in juxtaposition to that, you have outsiders who come in with very distinctive sets of expectations and assumptions. They have rules. They have paperwork. They have ideas about, you know, what makes sense to do to help people recover. And this is not to criticize those people, because they certainly are doing the best they can. And it's a very stressful situation, of course, for the helpers. What is not on the table at this point in the literature of disaster studies is how those groups of institutional representatives and organizational representatives, how we assume that they know what to do. We don't recognize that they themselves are bringing their own cultural values. FEMA may be an institution, and we may think of it as, you know, a governmental institution. FEMA has so many cultural values embedded in it, and we have to recognize that, because there are certain things, like, for example, the paperwork that FEMA produces that everyone has to fill out in order to become registered in their system requires you to indicate who is head of household and, you know, the number of people in your household. And there's no provision whatsoever for saying, but the way we live is in large groups. The meaningful unit is not the nuclear family.
Sounds like we're trying to put people into categories that those categories don't exist, and we're imposing categories that are reflective of, as you describe, middle America, white America culture, as opposed to embracing and understanding and recognizing the culture of the people who were most impacted by Hurricane Katrina.
Well, I think that's exactly what I'm saying. I think it's important as an insight, because it's just not yet perceived as an important thing to look at in disaster recovery. So going forward, I believe that if we could recognize that cultural variability is a critical awareness that we need to carry with us into the scene of a disaster impacted community, then there are all kinds of ways that are not so difficult, that don't cost money, that simply require attention and awareness, that we could fundamentally make rapid progress to reducing the suffering and shrinking the amount of time it requires for people hurt to actually recover their lives.